You're listening to the RBN Energy Blogcast. This is an audio version of RBN's Daily Energy Blog, which is a fun and informative daily commentary on oil, gas, NGL, and renewable markets. Each morning, we cover commodity fundamentals and industry changes to keep you informed of developing trends across the energy landscape.
Monday, August 30th, 2021. Hear my train a-comin'. The liquefaction train ramp-up process and timelines. Published by Sheetal Nasta. The year-on-year gain in U.S. LNG feed gas demand has been the single biggest factor behind the soaring natural gas prices and storage shortfall this year. And there is more of that demand on the horizon. Cheniere Energy Sabine Pass Train 6 and Venture Global's new Calcasieu Pass facility are due to start service in the first half of 2022. However, feed gas volume is likely to ramp up ahead of the new year as both projects progress through the commissioning phase and aim to export their first commissioning cargoes before the end of the year. How soon could that incremental feed gas demand show up? Getting a handle on the timing requires an understanding of how a liquefaction plant works and the various steps of the commissioning process. Today, we start a short series on what's involved when bringing a liquefaction plant online and what that can tell us about the timing of incremental feed gas flows this fall winter. Before we get to today's topic, we'd be remiss if we didn't touch on the devastating impact of what is now Tropical Depression Ida. Ida made landfall as a Category 4 hurricane just before noon on Sunday near Port Forkin along the eastern Louisiana coastline and remained a hurricane as it moved north toward Mississippi, bringing with it 6 to 12-foot storm surges, 150-mile-per-hour winds, and flash flooding. Energy reported extensive damage with more than 2,000 miles of transmission lines out of service and nearly 1 million customers without power early Monday, primarily in eastern Louisiana, saying it could be weeks before power will be restored in the hardest-hit areas. As for Louisiana's Gulf Coast LNG operations, Ida's easterly track largely spared the LNG export facilities from damage or shutdowns, and terminal operations appear to have remained relatively stable, only a temporary disruption to port and marine activity over the weekend. Lower 48 LNG feed gas deliveries as of Monday were at 9.6 BCF per day, down about 600 million cubic feet per day from recent days, with all that attributable to a drop in flows to Sabine Pass. However, that may be more due to maintenance on Transco pipeline than to storm impacts. Turning back to the topic of today's blog, the commissioning stages and timing of new feed gas demand this fall, when we last discussed the process of starting up new liquefaction trains back in 2019, LNG feed gas deliveries were just topping 5 BCF per day, but there was no less than 30 million metric tons per annum, equivalent to 4 BCF per day of liquefaction capacity, that was scheduled to come online over the course of that year. There's nowhere near that amount of liquefaction due online in the next few months or even in the next couple of years. Nevertheless, feed gas requirements of LNG export facilities have been just as big a driver of the lower 48 gas market this year as they were back then and will continue to be closely watched heading into this winter. As we detailed in such great heights, feed gas flows in 2021 have not only recovered from last year's pandemic-driven cargo cancellations but exceeded pre-pandemic levels as additional liquefaction capacity was added in late 2020 and early 2021. Gas deliveries to the LNG export terminals this injection season to date have averaged around 10 BCF per day, just about double the volume versus the same period last year. And, with two facilities currently in the midst of commissioning, feed gas demand is poised to rise still further in the coming months. Cheniere is in the process of commissioning its sixth liquefaction train at Sabine Pass in Louisiana for an incremental 5 million tons per annum, or 0.66 BCF per day, of capacity. The project is about 90% complete and is targeting substantial completion in the first half of 2022. The other project, as we noted earlier, is the new Calcasieu Pass facility, which is also in the commissioning phase. Venture Global is gunning to complete the first of the terminal's 18 modular trains in early 2022 and bring all 10 million tons per annum, or 1.3 BCF per day, of capacity online by the end of next year. Both projects are expected to produce first LNG before the end of 2021, adding more feed gas demand to an already bullish gas market heading into winter. When can we expect to see meaningful volumes of gas flowing to the facilities? Well, the commissioning and completion of these multi-process liquefaction units or facilities involves the startup and testing of a number of complex systems, with regulatory approvals required at each step. So, to understand the timing, it's worth taking a step back to get an idea of the different components of a liquefaction plant and how they fit together. Of course, the components and processes vary by facility, depending on the technology being used, among other things. Bear in mind, too, that we are not engineers. However, between projects' regulatory filings and other documentation and analysis of previous trains that have come online, we can glean some insights about the inner workings of liquefaction facilities and their startup processes. Next, we provide an overview of the key aspects of a liquefaction plant and the commissioning stages before delving deeper in the next part of this series into Sabine Pass Train 6 and Calcasieu Pass specifically. In the meantime, you can refer to our blog called Such Great Heights Part 2 for more details on these projects. We also provided updates of each in the latest LNG Voyager quarterly. Unlike piped natural gas, which is compressed and pressurized to move from point A to B, ship gas must be super-chilled to minus 260 degrees Fahrenheit into liquid form, which takes up only 1/600th the space as the gas form, in order for it to be loaded onto LNG tankers. But there's a lot that needs to happen between natural gas intake and LNG loading. At this point, an engineer might interject that there's more than one way to achieve liquefaction, and each method has its advantages and disadvantages in terms of economics and efficiency, depending on the scale of the facility and climate conditions, among other variables. For the sake of simplicity, we'll leave the technical debate to the engineers and focus at a high level on the main processes that are part and parcel of a liquefaction train. First, natural gas received at a liquefaction facility undergoes pretreatment to remove any components that would freeze or damage the cryogenic sections of the plant. Pretreatment typically involves acid gas, carbon dioxide and hydrogen sulfide removal, dehydration and mercury removal. Heavy hydrocarbon components, or C5+, are also removed before the feed gas is ready for liquefaction. The heavy hydrocarbons are typically further distilled to a point that is suitable for atmospheric storage and transportation by road to end users. At this stage, the gas can begin to be gradually chilled and condensed in a series of cryogenic heat exchangers, transferring heat from one fluid to another for cooling, or cold boxes containing brazed aluminum heat exchangers, which collectively make up the core of the liquefaction train, using refrigerants typically propane, ethylene and methane, that progressively cool down the gas. A propane refrigerant loop can pre-cool the feed gas down to as low as minus 31 degrees Fahrenheit before it enters the liquefaction plant, where other refrigerants, with greater cooling properties, are used to cool the dry feed gas further, ultimately bringing it down to that magic number, minus 260 degrees Fahrenheit, when the gas becomes fully liquefied. As the liquefied gas exits the last cold box and makes its way either to LNG storage tanks or the loading dock, it is end-flashed, or depressurized, which produces vapor or flash gas, that is then recovered and recycled by the boil-off gas system, for use as fuel gas or for reliquefaction. That's the basic liquefaction process, but there are all sorts of ancillary systems on-site that support these primary operations. For example, each of the refrigeration systems requires its own refrigerant compressors that, in turn, are typically powered by gas turbines or large electric motors. There are also the various monitoring and safety systems, which include the wet gas, dry gas, and marine flare systems to help manage abrupt changes in gas flows, such as during startup, shutdown, maintenance, or emergencies, the waste heat recovery systems, control systems, electrical infrastructure, utility connections, distribution systems, piping, marine berth, loading mechanisms, and so on. Without getting into the weeds of each of these, the point is that the various systems and subsystems undergo extensive testing and must pass through regulatory stage gates as part of the project's ramp-up process. As each new liquefaction train moves through testing and approvals, its feed gas intake picks up. Volumes are initially small and sporadic but build up to larger and more consistent levels as the train achieves first LNG production, first commissioning cargo, and, eventually, substantial completion and full commercial operation. It is common for LNG plants to ramp up steadily, with some intermittent shutdowns to pull commissioning strainers, used during startup and testing to trap debris and prevent it from affecting sensitive equipment and/or instrumentation in the downstream processes, and perform critical repairs. These repairs often occur shortly after the first cargo milestone is achieved. Commissioning activities can also expect to encounter unforeseen issues that need to be rectified before full operation, which can contribute to the erratic gas supply needs at the facility. In addition to creating uncertainty on the gas inlet side of things, the intermittent operations during the testing process can also result in commissioned tankers sometimes left lingering offshore awaiting the go/no-go signal while the operator works out the kinks onshore. The patchy feed gas volumes during the testing phase are evident in the historical flows associated with Train 1, or T1, at Sabine Pass as it went through the testing and regulatory milestones from initial startup in fall 2015 to substantial completion at mid-2016. Looking at the first liquefaction train at the facility provides a clearer picture of how feed gas volumes correlated with the various stages of commissioning. The first sign that T1 was ramping up was in late September 2015, when the project was cleared to introduce fuel gas to the train as well as the surrounding equipment and components that support the primary systems, referred to as outside battery limits or OSBL. These are typically negligible volumes of gas, less than 10 million cubic feet per day. About 2 weeks later, in early October 2015, the project was authorized to introduce a heat transfer fluid to the hot oil system used in the pretreatment process. Next, a month and a half later in mid-November 2015, came the fuel gas to power the turbines, and at that point the facility was also ready to introduce feed gas. Gas supply used for liquefaction as opposed to fuel gas for powering on-site systems, and refrigerants, i.e., propane and ethylene for the cooling liquefaction process. From there, it was another 20 days before gas deliveries picked up from less than 10 million cubic feet per day to upwards of 50 million cubic feet per day. By mid-December, the project introduced more fuel gas to begin testing its marine flare system, which led to volumes intermittently exceeding 100 million cubic feet per day in the latter half of the month before tapering again to near zero. The marine flare system is located near the loading dock and is used to safely dispose of vapors released from the LNG storage tanks or from the ships during loading. Nearly a month-long lull in feed gas deliveries followed, particularly in the second half of January 2016, when the facility's gas intake dropped to little more than 3 million cubic feet per day. It wasn't until mid-February 2016 that regulatory activity picked up again, with the authorization from the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, or FERC, to introduce process fluids to heat up the condensate storage tanks and truck loading system, which handles the heavy hydrocarbons we noted above that are removed from the gas stream. That's also when feed gas deliveries accelerated, jumping to as much as 580 million cubic feet per day in the second half of February, just before the first commissioning cargo was shipped. With the first cargo on its way, feed gas volumes again briefly subsided to less than 20 million cubic feet per day in early March 2016. This is also when the project began introducing fuel gas and heat transfer fluids for Train 2. By mid-March 2016, SPL's feed gas was consistently above 600 million cubic feet per day, just shy of T1's intake capacity. Volumes remained more or less elevated through much of April, as feed gas and refrigerants were introduced to T2. By late April 2016, however, the facility's storage was nearing capacity, and with no inbound ships approaching, feed gas intake abruptly dropped back to the 20 million cubic feet per day level. During this time, Sabine Pass filed for authorization to start full operations for T1. 8 days later, on May 3, 2016, that approval was granted, and volumes bounced back to the 600 to 700 million cubic feet per day level in short order, marking the end of the commissioning phase for T1. Based on that timeline, T1 testing was a 224-day affair, including about 140 days from the time fuel gas was first introduced to when the facility was taking substantial feed gas volumes, plus another 15 days for the first cargo to ship. It also was nearly a month after the first cargo that a second one was shipped out in mid-March. But after that, the pace of feed gas intake stabilized and exports quickened, with another six cargoes shipping out between mid-March and the full in-service of T1 in early May 2016. Sabine Pass's subsequent trains followed a similar pattern, but the intervals between fuel gas, feed gas, and first LNG production varied somewhat. For example, the commissioning of Sabine Pass's trains 2 and 4 overlapped with trains 1 and 3, respectively, allowing for some efficiencies between them. Sabine Pass Train 5 and Corpus Christi Train 3, on the other hand, were brought online more independently and likely serve as a better proxy for estimating Train 6 timelines. So, what does all this tell us about what we can expect with Sabine Pass Train 6 and Calcasieu Pass? Given that Sabine Pass is already online, feed gas associated specifically with Train 6 will be difficult to discern, especially since Cheniere's sales model allows it to exercise a lot of flexibility between its Sabine Pass and Corpus Christi plants. On the other hand, we should have a very clear window into feed gas flows to Calcasieu Pass as its first units ramp up. But its specific modular technology differs from most of the other terminals and makes it harder to predict, with the Elba Island export facility being the closest proxy. Regardless, FERC filings indicate that both projects have been notching regulatory and testing milestones in recent weeks and are getting closer to when they will begin to take more than just nominal volumes of feed gas. We can see that Sabine Pass Train 6 began commissioning its fuel gas system in late June/early July, and earlier this month was granted approval to commission the hot oil utility system. The filings also show that Calcasieu Pass has been submitting implementation plans and requests for a number of systems in recent weeks, and has received approval to commission the gas turbines, the liquid nitrogen system, and, most recently, also the hot oil system. In part 2 of this series, we'll take a closer look at these milestones to gauge potential timing of feed gas flows for each facility. Here My Train A-Comin' is a slow blues written by Jimi Hendrix. It has appeared in several live studio and jam sessions involving Hendrix between 1967 and 1970. No versions of the song were ever completed to Hendrix's satisfaction before his death in 1970. The first known recording of the song was with the Jimi Hendrix Experience, with Mitch Mitchell on drums and Noel Redding on bass for the BBC Top Gear radio program in December 1967. Hendrix has also called the song Getting My Heart Back Together in some versions. It has appeared in various forms on the albums Radio 1, BBC Sessions, Blues, Woodstock, Woodstock 2, Live at Woodstock, Midnight Lightning, Jimi Hendrix Experience box set, Valleys of Neptune, Both Sides of the Sky, as well as People, Hell, and Angels. Live performances of the tune can be seen in the films Experience, Jimi Hendrix, Woodstock, Rainbow Bridge, and Jimmy Plays Berkeley. Several live versions of the song can be streamed for free at the Experience Hendrix official website. Jimi Hendrix was an American guitarist, singer, songwriter, and musician from Seattle, Washington. He started playing guitar when he was 15. After playing the Chitlin circuit in his early 20s with the Isley Brothers, Little Richard, Wilson Pickett, and Curtis Knight, he was discovered at the Café Wa in New York City by Animals bassist Charles Chandler. Chandler became Hendrix's manager and producer, and moved him to London. Hendrix soon became a sensation in London and secured a record deal. He achieved fame in the US after his appearance at the Monterey Pop Festival in 1967. Hendrix released 3 studio albums, 3 live albums, and 14 singles with the Experience. He released 13 studio albums, 28 live albums, 19 compilation albums, 27 EPs, and 28 singles. He also recorded 1 live album with the band of Gypsies, rather than his original group. Another 23 official bootleg albums were released posthumously. He is a member of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and the UK Music Hall of Fame, and has a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame. He won 2 Grammy Awards, a Grammy Lifetime Achievement Award, and has a statue and park named after him in Seattle. He is considered by many to be one of the most influential guitarists and musicians to have ever lived. Hendrix died in London in September 1970. He was 27 years old.
Thanks for listening to the RBN Daily Energy Blogcast. For more information on energy market reports, maps, and consulting engagements, please visit us at rbnenergy.com. And thanks for rocking with us.